And now we return to the question and answer segment of the program. You're listening to independent scholar and author Norman Finkelstein.
Hi, Dr. Finkelstein. I thank you for coming and thank you for your talk. My question is, I have a lot of Jewish friends and family members who are Zionists, Jewish and non-Jewish Zionists, and I just maybe a couple of words about how to approach starting this conversation. I've been to the occupied territories. I have a lot of emotion around it, but I appreciate your words about being reasonable, but maybe some suggestions about how to approach that, starting that conversation.
Okay. My own view is, you know, as it happens, I wrote my doctoral dissertation in the subject of Zionism, so I have some sort of stake in it. But I don't think we need to use that kind of terminology. I don't think the issue is whether you're post-Zionist, Zionist, pre-Zionist, anti-Zionist, or anything else. I don't care. I have no interest whatsoever in your ideological propensities or predispositions. I want to know simple things. Do you believe in basic principles of justice? Do you think it's right to blow up a person's house? Is that right? Why is it that nowhere else in the world is it legal? Because everywhere else in the world it's understood to be collective punishment, but it's okay in Palestine. Is that right? Do you believe in torture? Is that right? If you stick, in my opinion, to basic principles, ordinary moral principles, and you draw on not what people with the so-called extremes have to say. There was a time when you were involved in this conflict and this issue where the only people you could cite were people, wonderful people, absolutely terrific people, but people who were well out of the mainstream. Someone like Leah Tzimmel, the Trotskyist lawyer in Israel, tremendous human being. Felicia Langer, the Communist Party lawyer. Israel Shahak, the organic chemist at Hebrew University. But now we don't have to cite people like that. Not that they aren't worthy of being cited, but in terms of credibility, it's just much easier. You just cite Human Rights Watch. You cite Amnesty International. You cite Gideon Levy. You cite Amira Haas. Can they all be anti-Semitic? Can they all be lying? Could every member of the International Court of Justice be lying, anti-Semitic? Then it starts being credible. And then the only reasonable, rational conclusion is, well, if they're all saying it, then maybe it's true. And I think that's the most likely approach to win people over. Cite mainstream sources. Don't make ideological litmus tests. You know, a prerequisite for this conversation is you have to be an anti-Zionist. Who cares? I used to be a person on the left. I still am. But believe me, there are a lot of nasty people on the left. Very nasty people. I wouldn't want to see half of them in a dark alley. You know? When I went through, and I don't want to belabor it, just as in point, when I went through my tenure battle, the left, the Progressive magazine, said I was a Holocaust denier. The Nation magazine said Dershowitz and Finkelstein deserve each other. And then who came out slugging in my defense? It was odd. The person who came out slugging was a conservative Republican, Raoul Hilberg, the world's leading authority in the Nazi Holocaust. Who would have guessed it? My ideological allies stabbed me twice and twisted a dagger. And then a conservative Republican who prided himself on the fact that every morning he read with great interest the Wall Street Journal, he came to my defense. A good German friend of mine said, Norman, character tells you much more about a person than ideology. So forget about whether or not you're a Zionist. Just ask basic principles about morality and justice. And I think there's a good chance. You know, remember, right now, if you read the polling, Israel is losing huge amounts of ground among Jews. They're losing a whole younger generation, and they're panicking about it. That's why they have this whole birthright Israel, because they have lost the whole under 40 generation. So it's not so difficult to win over people. Even ISM, the International Solidarity Movement, the brave, courageous young people who went over to defend the Palestinians, you know, the estimates were about 30% were Jewish, which is a very impressive showing, in my humble opinion. So I don't think it's so difficult. Yes?
Yeah. With the group of people that don't believe that Israel has the right to exist, how will it be that there will be a settlement, considering their the embitterment that they have? And also, on that same note, I guess it's that, personally, I wonder, how do they have the right to exist in a modern world as a religious state, and not at least join with the people that live there indigenously as a place called Palestine? What can be wrong with this in the end?
Look, number one, nobody's asking the Palestinians or anyone else to recognize Israel's right to exist. No one asked the Cherokee or the Navajo or the Iroquois to recognize the United States' right to exist. That concept doesn't exist. There is a legal concept, and it's the right of any member state in the United Nations to exist free from threats or use of force. That is to say, differences have to be resolved diplomatically. And that, to me, is a reasonable principle. I don't see this, we don't have to get involved in this nonsensical talk about a right to exist. As to the rest of what you had to say, look, I happen to be a person of the left. I don't believe in any states. And I don't think it's enough to have one state. You say, why can't people live together in one state? Well, I also think, why can't people live together with a relatively equitable distribution of wealth in one state? There are a lot of there are a lot of things which are wrong, in my opinion, which are wrong with the world. And certainly if we get, you know, we manage to effect a full Israeli withdrawal, and then that's not the end of the struggle. There are many things that still have to be struggled for. South Africa has one state. Is there anyone in this room who thinks now everything is over in South Africa? We have reached the promised land? No, the struggle continues. It's a question not of whether this is an ideal solution. The question is there any alternative at this point to trying, you know, as the old black spiritual had it? You know, it's climbing one more rung on Jacob's ladder. And that, for me, is all that it's about. It's not over, but it's an important rung to end that hideous occupation. But that doesn't mean we end the struggle there. And I don't see why people have gotten this weird idea in their head that if we just had one state, we would have reached, you know, nirvana. Hey, we have one state in the United States. I don't think it's great shakes.
Hi, Dr. Finkelstein. I have a question in regards to one of your main arguments that the facts are clear and don't have to be abstract up in the air. My question is, I wonder if the following two things that I'm about to mention actually blur the clear lines that you have laid out, one of which the reality or that the West Bank and Gaza Strip were annexed and occupied by Egypt and Jordan pre-67, and also the very real rhetoric of Arab nationalist leaders like Mr. Gamal Abdel Nasser, that of having Israel be destroyed and going back to pre-1948 reality. Do you think that in any way blurs and complicates the very concrete facts and realities that you've outlined?
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, it's true that Jordan annexed the West Bank. It was recognized by two countries in the world, Great Britain and Pakistan. And Egypt occupied the Gaza as an interim measure until the conflict was resolved. I don't see how it really changes anything. I'm not going to go through that history now. And I don't think there's a necessity to go through that history now. You can make all sorts of arguments. You know, you can't make much of an argument for the annexation of the West Bank, but, you know, the plucky little king, as Abdullah was called, he was a hoodlum. And that's why the British put him in power, or he became a hoodlum after they put him in power, whatever. I don't think that complicates the picture very much. If it complicated the picture, there'd be evidence of it. You see, that's what troubles me, is people don't want to see. If there were evidence, if what I was saying were not true, you should find visible signs of it in the record. If it were complicated, or the picture were complicated, how do you explain the fact that the vote in the World Court was 14-1? They looked through all the historical legal issues, and they still came to the conclusion West Bank, Gaza, East Jerusalem, occupied Palestinian territory, settlements illegal under international law. If you look at the annual vote in the United Nations General Assembly, if it were complicated, you should look at that resolution, by the way. It comes to 4 pages. It is a very lengthy, detailed resolution. Nonetheless, on a 4-page resolution, and you know how difficult it is for any of you who have ever worked in a group to get a group statement of 3 sentences to get people to agree on. This is 4 pages, the whole world, except U.S., Israel, Nauru, Palau, Tuvalu, Micronesia, and Marshall Islands. It must tell you, it seems to me, the rational conclusion is that these are not really controversial or complicated issues. That, I think, is the only possible conclusion you can reach. As to the statements people make, a lot of people make stupid statements. Are they obstacles? Well, you know, the defense minister, deputy defense minister of Israel, a couple of weeks ago says he's going to commit a Holocaust in Gaza. That's not a very pretty statement either. If we're going to start using statements people make as an excuse for not resolving the conflict, we can find statements on all sides. All sides have made ugly statements. And frankly, in the great scheme of things, statements count much less than actions. Judge me by what I do and not what I say. So Israel can make all the most beautiful statements in the world as it proceeds to destroy the state of Palestine. And that counts for much more morally than what Hamas might say on this or that occasion. And frankly, you know, people under occupation, look, my parents went through the Nazi Holocaust. And they, to the end of their lives, if I ever dared say anything positive about a German or a Pole, you know, I was inviting a lot of trouble. Now, I felt a lot of what they said about Germans and Poles was wrong. In fact, I thought it was emphatically wrong. But I can understand, after what they went through, that they're going to make statements like that. It's not so difficult for me to comprehend. And I never quarreled with them about it. I just understood. You enter into that argument, you're opening up such, you know, an ugly past. I'm not going to do it. You know? I'm not going to go to my best friend Musa. His father lives in Fuwar refugee camp, entire life destroyed, and go over to him and say to him, well, you know, Jews aren't so bad. No, I'm not going to do it. Why? If you want to look for excuses not to settle the conflict, there are 10,000. But if you're looking for a way to resolve the conflict, be reasonable, understand people's feelings, understand where they're coming from, and we can all resolve it. It's not so difficult.
You just kind of lightly touched on this. I was wondering what you think of arguments that draw parallels between South African apartheid and the two-state solution. And also if you think that a one-state solution with all Palestinians having genuine democratic influence is the ideal goal.
Well, on the issue of the apartheid analogy, it's completely uncontroversial, so long as you're referring to the West Bank and Gaza. There's no controversy. When Jimmy Carter put it in the title of his book, oh, there was all of this hysteria. How could he make such a comparison, so terrible, so awful? And then you opened up last week Israel's main news, most influential newspaper, Haaretz, and their lead editorial is entitled Our Debt to Jimmy Carter. And what did they write? They said, well, Israelis don't like Jimmy Carter because he put that word apartheid in the title of his book. And then Haaretz writes, but, and I'm quoting them verbatim, the situation begs for the comparison. There's no controversy. Former Minister of Education Shulamit Aloni, she made an analogy. Former Minister of Education Yossi Sarid, just 3 weeks ago, he says if it waddles like a duck, it quacks like a duck, well, it's apartheid. Former Israeli Attorney General Michael Ben-Yair, he makes the comparison. Beth Selim, in its reports, routinely makes the comparison. There's nothing controversial about it. It's only controversial in the never-never land of American Jewry and the American media, but nowhere else in the world. Now, you could disagree with it, but to claim it's controversial, you know, that's the way you get a job at the New York Times. On the issue of one state, you know, I've told you, I'm a person of the left, was of the left, and I'll even reveal, I'm supposed to be embarrassed about it, but I'm not. I was in the past a Maoist, Chairman Mao. Dare to struggle, dare to win. Mao Zedong, live like him. All right. Okay. But, you know, he said a lot of things which were smart, in my opinion. And one of the things he said is, in politics, the fundamental principle should be unite the many to defeat the few. Not unite the few to defeat the many. And my view is, our first responsibility, and we shouldn't lose sight of it. It's easy for me to lose sight of it. You know, I don't want to pretend otherwise. You start going on these speaking tours and you forget what it's all about. It's very easy. But you know, you have to do what that old black spiritual said, keep your eyes on the prize, to remember what it's all about. You know, it's about the suffering of the Palestinian people under occupation and the refugees. That's what it's about. And if that's what it's about, then your first responsibility is to try to figure out the best strategy for ending that occupation. And the best strategy, I think Mao Zedong is right. Unite the many to defeat the few. That is to show the whole world supports ending it at a June 67 border. The International Court of Justice, the human rights organizations, and what Jimmy Carter keeps hammering away. He keeps saying, look, I talked to Hamas, they're ready. I talked to Syria, they're ready. The only ones who are blocking it are Israel. And I think that's right. Isolate, defeat the few. The moment you start talking about one state, that's exactly what Israel wants. So they can say, you see, we're not the only ones who oppose the international community. We're not the only ones who oppose the world court. They oppose it also. They're against the two-state solution. They're against the withdrawal to the June 67 border. That's exactly what they want, to get out of that isolation or to re-isolate the other side, to show we're both unreasonable. And I think that's exactly what we should steer clear of. Unite the many, defeat the few. Isolate those who are the obstacle to trying to resolve at least the core of the problem for now, the occupation and the refugees. That's how I see it. It has nothing to do with what I have as a personal preference. I still believe in those old values. The full development of each is the condition for the full development of all. distribution according to need. I still believe that. I don't go, that's where I'm at, and that's where I'll be till my last dying day. But that's not going to confuse for me what we need to do right now in the here and now. And right now in the here and now, we have to end that occupation, because it's not only brutal, it's becoming, for a segment of that population, it's becoming literally unlivable. And that's what we have to end. You have to get those, you know, you have to get those occupying forces out of there. And then we can start thinking about something else.
I'm wondering if you could briefly talk about your view of the media and public opinion, however you choose to define either. Mm-hmm. And do you see them as being essential toward the resolution? Do you see them as being dysfunctional to the point where they can't actually play a significant role, or is it some combination of the two?
Well, it all depends on what you mean by the media. Remember, bear in mind, there are people in the room who are older, and they should remember that the very last people to turn around on the war in Vietnam were the leading media. You know, till the bitter end, everybody now talks about, why can't we have the days again of Walter Cronkite? You know, Walter Cronkite was the most wretched, disgusting apologist for the United States. He used to read, you know, till the last days he was supporting the war in Vietnam. The main media turned around after elites in the United States turned around, which is usually dated at the time of the Tet Offensive in 1968. Until then, the main media were still solidly saying what, as you would expect, what the government would want them to say. So I don't think we should be looking there in order to gauge what's happening. They're the last. What's clear to me, and I've, you know, been at it for now a quarter of a century, what's clear to me is political opinion has radically changed. On the Israeli side, if you go, for example, to a college campus, they've been reduced to what you could call their ethnic core. If they have an Israel event, let's say a 60th anniversary event, only Jews will show up. And of the Jews, it's probably only around one-third of the Jews on campus. One-third are totally indifferent, and one-third are supporting the Palestinians. So Jews are reduced to their ethnic core. On the Palestinian side, they'll attract a large number of people from the mainstream, which is to say, on the Palestinian side, it's going outside its ethnic core, and it's becoming a human issue. It's not a Palestinian issue, it's a human issue. Our side, and I don't say it with rose-tinted glasses, I'm very realistic about the world, I've had enough experience, but our side is clearly winning. It's plain as day. The other side is a complete disaster. It's falling apart. And they know it, and they're panicking. That's why you read all of these articles about what they call, if you read the literature of the Jewish community, American Jews, and the word they use is distancing themselves from Israel. And what can we do to reverse this phenomenon? They're terrified by the fact that it's up, it's over. It's falling apart because Israel is simply carrying on in a way which, however much the media tries to spin it and misrepresent it, enough of the truth has seeped in that it's carrying on in a way which is an embarrassment. Most American Jews remain what they always have been in the United States, that is to say, liberal in their values, believe in the rule of law, and so on and so forth, for no other reason than that's those values were what enabled American Jews to thrive in American society. Principles like separation of church and state, rule of law, and so forth. And it's impossible any longer to adhere to liberal values, basic liberal values, and support what Israel is doing. Enough is known, obviously still only a small part of the truth, but enough is known that it's become indefensible, and Jews are falling away. You see it everywhere. I see it all the time, and people are always writing me about, you know, this example, that example, of how It's falling apart on the other side. I see no reason at all for despair, but don't look up there, you know, to gauge public opinion. I think there's every reason to be hopeful so long as we do two things. Number one, stick to the facts, and number two, be reasonable. And reasonable does not mean sacrificing principles. No, you stick by the principles. But being reasonable is not trying to create a new set of principles to prove that you're more politically pure than others, but at the cost of isolating ourselves. Some people like the isolation of martyrdom, and I'm, you know, there's a little bit of Jesus in all of us, you know. But and there's a certain, you know, pleasure that one may derive from it. But politically, it's a complete disaster. Politically, we want to reach people. And I think it's well within our possibility now of reaching people. If we're reasonable and if we show it's the other side, it's absolutely unreasonable. They don't want to budge. Okay, that's it.
You've been listening to independent scholar and author Norman Finkelstein. The title of the lecture is Israel and Palestine, Roots of Conflict, Prospects for Peace. Norman Finkelstein spoke at the University of Washington Ethnic Cultural Theater in Seattle, Washington on May 8, 2008. For more information about Norman Finkelstein and his work, please visit his website at www.normanfinkelstein.com. This program was produced by PDX Justice Media Productions. To find out more about our work, please visit our website at www.pdxjustice.org. You'll find streaming audio and video programs featuring speakers such as Diana Butu, Paul Krugman, Susan Faludi, Phyllis Bennis, Rashid Khalidi, and many others. Thanks for tuning in. And thanks for supporting listener-sponsored radio, public access cable television, net neutrality, and all forms of grassroots, democratic, community media.